Hey everyone, I'm Jeannie, I use she, her pronouns, and you're listening to Sex Talk Happy Hour, a podcast hosted by the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault. It's the end of May, and if colleges and universities haven't already had their commencement ceremonies, they're definitely about to. Since it's the end of the traditional academic year, we thought we'd focus a little bit on colleges and universities for this episode. College campuses and college students have always been central to movements against gender-based violence. For example, one of the first major appearances of the term date rape in a major publication showed up after a young woman named Katie was raped by a person she'd gone on a date with her freshman year, first semester. Another example is the One Love Foundation, an organization that currently focuses on preventing dating violence. It was founded after Yardley Love, a college athlete at the University of Virginia, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend just 3 weeks before graduation. More recently, organizations such as No Red Tape, Know Your Nine, End Rape on Campus, Safer, It's on Us, and so many others have led the way on changing campus policies, informing public safety procedures, and educating students of their rights. Anyway, at the end of this traditional academic year, we thought it would make sense to focus on the work being done at colleges and universities. More specifically, we're going to be talking about artivism, or activism through art. Okay, it's not a real word because I definitely made it up, but it has a nice ring to it, right? Students on college campuses have always led these movements, and many times their messages and demands show up through some form of art. So today's episode will be in three parts. First, we talk to a graduated alumnus about the artivism they engaged in during their senior year and the art that they're doing now. Then you'll hear from a currently enrolled student who created a magazine on campus. And finally, you'll be hearing from two professors and their students about a performance piece that has turned into an awareness and education program for their entire school. As always, we encourage you to take care of yourselves in whatever ways you may need as you listen, as some of the material may be triggering for some listeners. Part one, we're going to be talking to someone who graduated from college a few years ago and about the work and artivism that they did while they were on campus and the work that they do now. Hi. Okay, thank you so much for being here today. Can you introduce yourself, the pronouns you use, what you do, and why some of our listeners might recognize your name?
All right. Well, I'm an artist and an activist. I use the pronoun they. People would probably know me because of Mattress Performance Carry That Weight, which was a 9-month endurance performance art piece that I did at Columbia University for my senior year. I was sexually assaulted on the first day of my sophomore year by one of my classmates, and in this piece, I decided to carry a mattress, a dorm room mattress, the same type that I was assaulted on, everywhere I went on Columbia's campus for as long as I continued to go to school with him. There's kind of, I think, a misinterpretation of the piece in which it's all about me trying to get him kicked off campus with this piece. But the reason I made Mattress Performance was because I'd already reported my assault to the school and I'd already reported my assault to the police, and both avenues for me to try and take action via system that was already in place had failed me, and the two other women who'd actually also been assaulted by him. And then even later, another survivor came out about it, another transgender survivor, and there were other survivors of him that I'd talked to that weren't confident enough to report their cases. So I actually made that piece not to get my rapist kicked off campus, because I already knew he wouldn't be. I was interested in the idea that all of us survivors would have to spend 9 months on campus with him. An academic year is 9 months long. And 9 months also happens to be the length of a pregnancy. So I was interested in sort of the weird resonance between me carrying a weight in the same way that a woman might carry a child and then release it at the end. And it wasn't just for me. Like, I always want to emphasize that. It was for all of us. So I know that the question was simpler than that, but I wanted to kind of fill in some extra stuff.
What were the reactions that you got from your classmates or professors about the project?
I mean, to my face, everyone was really civil and even supportive. I think a number of people would be like, do you believe Emma? Right? That was like a big question that people would like talk about at parties. And all my friends were like, how is this a debate? But yeah, when they were speaking to me, at least, they would be very kind.
So, just to be clear, despite the fact that you did everything you were quote-unquote supposed to do, like reporting to the police and going to your school administrators, people were still skeptical about whether or not you were telling the truth about your assailant?
Well, that was precisely why. Because if Columbia couldn't find him responsible and the police weren't helpful, it must be my fault, right? Like that. So I think that if the systems in place had worked, people would have believed me more. But people who've never had to endure those processes themselves don't realize how messed up those sorts of systems are and think that they work. And think that if they couldn't find him responsible or guilty, then he probably wasn't guilty.
Wow, that's very interesting. A lot of people refer to you as the mattress girl. How do you feel about that? It seems far too simple for what the actual project was.
Right. I mean, it's a diminutive term, right? I think that what's mostly the most frustrating thing about the mattress girl is that it is so flattening of me, and I'm still an artist. I've made so many other types of work since then, and the mattress girl doesn't really accommodate for the fact that I'm a living being who grows and changes and makes other work, and that's why I prefer my name, Emma Sulkowitz.
I mean, that makes sense. Okay, so you use art to promote awareness. What types of messages do you like to promote through art, and why is art the medium of your choice?
I've gotten asked versions of this question throughout my short career, and I always have to answer it kind of backwards, because I think there are many artists and many people who are like, I have a message I want to get across, let me find a way, oh, art would be great, let me use art to like promote my message. But I don't really have that freedom. I make art and then have to look at it and think, okay, what am I trying to say in this? And then I'm like, oh, it's probably because I'm upset about this thing, and then I can refine the art. But my art comes from so deep in my unconscious that I'm not really able to be that kind of person who's like, I'm going to make artwork about solitude in society and then do something about that. I'm always like, I have this image in my head of me carrying a mattress. Why is that? And then I'm like, oh, maybe it's about what happened. Okay, well, if it's about what happened, then how do I make it better?
That's so fascinating, and it makes a lot of sense. So what are you working on now? Is there anything you'd like to share or promote about your work, current or future? Where can our listeners follow you?
My solo show in Brooklyn just closed, and honestly, I don't have anything really coming up right now. But when I do, the first place you can find out about it is definitely my Instagram. I'm trying to get into Twitter. It's a slow process. On Facebook, I'm just Emma Sulkowitz. On Instagram, I'm E-M-S-U-L-K, and on Twitter, if, you know, I can start to figure out how to make that work, it's E-S-U-L-K.
Got it. We'll definitely include all of those details in our episode description for sure. Would you be willing to tell us more about your project that just closed in Brooklyn?
Oh, yeah. So the solo show I had in Brooklyn was titled The Floating World, which is a translation of the Japanese word ukyo, which sort of came to prominence during the Edo period in Tokyo, where there was a sort of blossoming of geishas, courtesans, bathhouses, kabuki theater, these pleasure centers in the city, and people would sort of escape to those places to get away from the dreary everyday life that they lived, right? The word ukyo is homophonous with the Buddhist term for this world of sorrow and grief. So there's this kind of recognition that you might escape to these places in order to escape from grief or sorrow. I have always been fascinated with that because my grandma was the mama of one of the biggest hostess clubs in Tokyo. So that moment in Japanese history has sort of been filtered down to me. I came up with The Floating World during a performance I did a little over a year ago now called The Ship is Sinking, in which I was bound in shibari, which is Japanese rope bondage that originated with samurai but is now kind of like a kinky thing, and I was hung from the ceiling of the gallery. And it's very painful to be tied up in rope, like, you get bruised, and it's another physical endurance kind of performance. But at the same time, I felt like it was the epitome of support, because my co-performer had to be so conscious and sensitive about all of my body weight in order to lift me off the ground. So I became very interested in that as a metaphor. It's a metaphor for our relationships with the people we love, because often our bonds to the people we love can be tenuous or even painful, but when we're in pain, they're the ones who support us. They're the ones who lift us up, literally, right? So I made portraits of people I love. They're 3 family members and 2 friends in this show. And I used a sort of hybrid shibari rope style to suspend each portrait in the gallery to sort of show the way that support works. And each portrait is a glass fishbowl with things floating inside. So each one literally looks like a floating world, but references that, like, escaping from sorrow and grief that comes with support.
Can you share with us how the 5 people you featured reacted to being featured in your work?
Oh, they were happy. Yeah, they were really happy. I combined the shibari rope style with ukidama netting, which are Japanese fishing floats. Traditional Japanese fishermen would have these inflated, using glass blowing, recycled sake bottles that they would seal, and then they were filled with air, and they would tie them to the perimeter of their fishing net so that their fishing net wouldn't sink to the bottom of the floor. So I looked at some antique ukidama and taught myself that kind of netting technique. And each globe is suspended with shibari knots, but then held in an ukidama net. And I liked the idea of each of these floating worlds being a sort of node or a point on a network, literally like making a net. And, you know, this is the net that catches me when I fall, right? The people who do that. There's a lot of value nowadays put on like a social network, which is kind of cold and not necessarily what I'm so interested in. I wanted to show a network that functioned more like a community, right? Like, literally, each portrait is round. They're these glass globes, which is supposed to be juxtaposed to, you know, the kind of flat images that we see on Instagram, or like the square-shaped profile picture you have on Facebook. So, yeah, I wanted to make these sort of rounded-out portraits of these people that are in my community / network that have supported me throughout everything that I've been through.
So I want to ask, since most folks know you and your work from the mattress performance when you were at Columbia, I'm curious as to whether or not you have any thoughts about campus policies or programming.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you already know about Columbia's shift thing. After mattress performance, Columbia has decided that they're going to spend, I think it's over $2.5 million, or maybe even precisely $2.5 million, to research the conditions that are conducive to sexual assault on campuses. And there was a big piece in The New Yorker on this recently. And, you know, it's going to be the biggest research initiative regarding sexual assault on college campuses ever. So sound the trumpets, like, Columbia is doing amazing things, but I'm happy that they're focusing on it. But to me, spending a bunch of money researching something kind of takes the pressure off of people in important administrative positions from actually having to do anything. So if your case is not dealt with according to the rules set forth in the Columbia Proceedings Manual, you're allowed to submit an appeal to the dean, which I did because my hearing process didn't follow the rules that they've even set out for themselves. So I wrote him a letter outlining every single way in which the administrators didn't follow their own rules and asked for a retrial of my assault case. And he said that he would meet with the panelists on his own and then decide whether, and he did that, and he was like, and we've decided no. So then me and my friend went to his office. We just went to the dean's office and were like, how can you say no? How can you look me in the eye and say no? I mean, here are the ways in which your administration didn't follow its own rules, and in the rule book, it says that if they don't follow their own rules, we're allowed to have a retrial. And he said, get out of my office. So $2.5 million isn't going to fix that. So for me, it's like policy can only bring us so far, and research can only bring us so far. Like, what's going to really make a difference is when people in those powerful positions decide that actually they do care.
That's a pretty powerful statement. Do you have any thoughts on the Me Too movement on college campuses?
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy that, like, for example, Bill Cosby being found guilty, right? Like, that would have never happened 5 years ago, even 4 years ago. So I think that it's almost as if what happened to me and the other students who were assaulted by the same guy happened too early, because nowadays when a bunch of survivors come out all at once together, people listen to them in a way that didn't used to happen. I mean, that's progress. I'm sort of like, oh, I wish it happened 4 years earlier. But yeah, it's just evidence that people are starting to care about this more, and that it's actually permeated society to that level. Like, the fact that we even have a word for this movement, the Me Too movement, even if it doesn't really fully encompass everything, is such a huge step for us that I'm very happy about that.
Same here. And I feel like Emma's sentiments are echoed by many on that front. One thing Emma didn't mention, by the way, is that those dorm room mattresses weigh about 50 pounds, so it definitely was an endurance performance. I was actually attending graduate school at Columbia at the time of this piece, and I once saw Emma walking around the main campus with that 50-pound mattress, though they did have lots of help at the time. Also, their Floating World piece that just closed in Brooklyn is really, really beautiful, and you can actually see the pictures of the exhibit on their Instagram. I highly recommend. Of course, we'll be putting all of Emma's social media in the description of this episode, so make sure you follow them and their incredible work there. Up next, part two, I spoke to a currently enrolled student who used to intern here at the New York City Alliance, who has spearheaded a pretty cool project that I hope you'll find interesting, especially to those of you who like fashion and photography and poetry.
My name is Maria. I use she, her, and I go to school at New York University.
Thanks so much for being here, Maria. Okay, so you're here to tell us about Survivors. What is it, and why did you start it?
So Survivors presently is a program with the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault that uses the arts to empower survivors of sexual violence and spread awareness. I started it in the fall of 2016, and interning with the Alliance was a really amazing experience for me, in part because it was part of my healing process as a survivor. I went into the Alliance identifying as an ally and kind of an outsider that wanted to help survivors, but the more time that I spent at the Alliance and began to learn the signs of survivorship, I realized that I too am a survivor of sexual violence. And so one of the ways that I often find control over my identity, over my representation, and really am able to explore like the nuances of myself is through fashion and photography. And I think that what's cool about my generation, or that I've seen a lot of, is that when we engage in photo shoots with one another, it's not like the photographer imposing their vision onto the subject. It's them working collaboratively and making sure that it's a safe space and a creative process for everyone every step of the way. And so I thought I wanted to give that opportunity to kind of explore your identity and reclaim that autonomy over your representation to other survivors of sexual violence. So I pitched the idea to the Alliance, and everyone was so on board and so supportive of the idea. And we began Survivors Magazine. We would do photo shoots with survivors in which we would meet with them beforehand and talk about their concept and their idea for how they want to be represented. Sometimes they would come to the meeting with tens of ideas, and sometimes they would come with none. And that's why we got a photographer, a makeup artist, a stylist, and a creative consultant on board to kind of help shape that idea and make sure that all of the survivors' ideas, whether or not they're an artist or photographer, are being represented through that art form in the way that they want it to. And so we did 10 photo shoots from the fall of 2016 to the spring of 2017, and we released our first edition in April of 2017. And we had a relatively small event. I would say probably like 50 to 75 people came throughout the evening when we had a gallery space with some of the photos from the magazine on the wall. But the feedback that we did get was really positive, and so we decided to keep going with the project, and we started Survivors Magazine Volume 2, which we just released this April 2018. In that time frame, we also had a lot of survivors asking if they could get involved with arts that wasn't just fashion and photography, like writing, that being poetry and prose, as well as their own photography and visual art as well. So we decided to put out a Survivors Anthology. We requested submissions via social media, and we got over 100 submissions from writers all over the country, and we were able to narrow that down to roughly 26 phenomenal pieces of poetry, visual art, and photography, and some prose as well. And we put that out as the Survivors Anthology, and people really connected with that, especially the people that were involved. Really, the feedback that we received was just very touching in terms of how impactful it is for survivors to be able to have space where they feel their narratives are heard, and where they really, in that sense, have complete control over what narrative is being told because it's their own writing and their own artwork. With that said, we expanded our mission from just using fashion and photography to using the arts in general, and we have a couple exciting projects coming up that are using even more forms than just those art forms I've listed. That's kind of how it transitioned from Survivors Magazine to now just being Survivors with the Alliance, because we're doing so much more than just the magazine now, although the magazine is definitely what brought people to the project and what anchors us along the way.
That's awesome, and congratulations on the growth, by the way. Okay, so why did you choose art as the medium, and specifically fashion and photography, for the first iteration of Survivors Magazine?
In the beginning, I chose fashion and photography because I felt like fashion uniquely, being art that you put on your body, really helped me personally, and now I have seen it in other survivors as well, have control over your identity and over your representation, which is something that is really taken from you. Not all survivors want to have to narrate their survivorship or have to go into detail of what happened or the aftermath in order to identify as a survivor. And I don't think that sharing your story through words should have to be a requirement to join this conversation. So with fashion and photography, we're allowing survivors to express themselves and still express their narratives in ways that they may have not thought of before, or in some cases they have, without ever having to disclose what happened or what their healing process has been. Like, when we meet with the survivors before their photo shoot, we never ask them any details of their assault or the aftermath. Sometimes survivors have willingly offered that information, but in many cases they don't, because they want a space where they can identify as a survivor and show what that looks like without actually having to explain the details, which so often media or movements demand.
That's a really good point to hone in on, because one of the major criticisms of the Me Too movement is that it can feel like an invisible pressure for survivors or victims to disclose. Has the movement had an effect on you or your program at all? And if so, in what ways?
So I am very thankful for the Me Too movement in terms of the awareness that it has brought, because when we were doing the event in April of 2017, I remember telling the audience, like, this is very much about bringing awareness to sexual violence. How are we supposed to address a problem that so many people don't even know exists? And I had a completely different message at this year's event, because people now know the gravity of the situation thanks to the Me Too movement. But that definitely is my biggest qualm with the movement in terms of placing that burden on survivors to have to disclose to join the movement, and also how, especially when there was that in the beginning, that like height of everybody coming out, like I personally couldn't go on social media, like it was too triggering for me to see all of these people disclose their stories. But I think that a lot of survivors do want to disclose their stories, and especially in the response that we receive with the anthology, a lot of them is literally just narratives of what happened, and that's in many ways very healing for a survivor to have a safe space to share those narratives. So I think we just have to make sure that every step of the way, we're making clear that that's not a requirement, that it's an option, that you can still be part of this movement and never have to say me too. And I think that starts just by believing people.
Yeah, I completely agree. It sounds like you and your team are really thoughtful about making sure that every person you come into contact with for this program has full autonomy over their narrative and representation. So what are you most proud of with this program?
I think what I'm most proud of with this project is probably the way that it has transformed to include other art forms and to get creative with the more safe spaces that we can make for survivors to express themselves. For example, one of the projects that we're working on now is with an organization called Shared Studios. Essentially, they have what used to be old shipping containers, and they turn them into these virtual spaces where you walk in and there's a big screen. It feels like you are looking and being in the same space with a person in the shipping container in another part of the world. What we're working on right now is creating dialogue with survivors globally so that survivors can be in a studio in New York and connect with survivors in a different part of the world, whether it's an English-speaking country or we get a translator involved. I think that is just a testament to, like, we started with creating a safe space in photo studios and using kind of photography to do that. And then we switched to, like, well, we don't even need to meet in person. Let's just get submissions and have that be a safe space in terms of, like, we're going to publish what they send us. And now we're, like, literally creating safe spaces for survivors to have conversations that may otherwise not be able to happen. And think about, like, how can we make this movement a global movement? And what does that even look like or mean? And so just showing that, like, there are ways to create safe spaces within communities and creative ways that may make people more comfortable than others. You just have to be willing to find them and be willing to put in the effort to create them. And what I have found is that survivors will show up. If you put it out, survivors will come.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like there's already been so much growth since the first magazine and in such a short period of time, which is really impressive. This is a really great transition into my next question, which is, what is your dream visualization for the future of survivors?
I'm kind of thinking in like a year in advance right now, just because we have so many immediate goals and projects. One of those being the Shared Studios project, where we're going to put survivors in conversation around the world to understand how survivorship differs in geography and cultural identity and political context. We're also working on volume 3 of Survivors Magazine, which we've decided we're going to have be a mixture of like the photo shoot experience, but also allowing to those submissions for poetry and prose because we had such success with the anthology. And then we're also working on a clothing line called Consent. It's in conversation right now in partnership with an existing clothing line called America Hates Us. And essentially in thinking about, okay, we've brought awareness to sexual violence, how do we turn the focus towards prevention? And I think one of the keys to prevention that is so underrated is consent. What consent means and what it means to different individuals and how you can practice healthy consent. Let's make consent sexy in terms of, like, literally somebody wants to wear it. Furthermore, like, when you buy those products, you have a responsibility as a consumer for when people ask you, like, oh, consent, like, what clothing line is that? You have a responsibility to say, like, oh, it's actually referring to sexual consent. Let's talk about it. What does that mean to you? This is what it means to me. This is how I think you should practice it, but do you think differently? So those are kind of, like, the three main projects we have our sights on right now, and those will all be released towards the end of 2018 and throughout 2019. And as I'm graduating in May of 2019, I think one of my other goals too is just making sure that I get people on board and committed to this project so that if I have to kind of take a step back in leadership, that this program is something that can keep going.
Yeah, that's super important. I want to go back to something you said earlier about making sure each survivor you work with has full autonomy. So often in the fashion remodeling or performance world, people are just expected to put up with unwanted touch because, you know, quote unquote, that's the business. What do you and your team do to ensure everyone you work with has this autonomy?
I think the first step is making clear that it's a safe space, and I think one of the keys to do that is making sure that it's an honest space. What I tell my team before we meet with any of the participants is, like, make sure that you're being a consultant. And then when I speak with the participant, I tell them, like, the creative team is aware that, like, while we have our knowledge in different art forms and whatnot, please see us kind of as just consultants. We're going to recommend ideas to you. You might love the idea and you might hate the idea, and please be honest with us. And that's all we really ask of the participant, is that, like, making clear that our feelings are not going to be hurt if, like, we suggest an idea and they don't like it. And we're happy when they're happy too. And so I think a key to that really is, like, driving home that honesty and that this space is centered around them. In terms of actually being in the space, in the photo studio, literally just asking if it's okay to touch them. Both photographers, we've worked with two different ones, and in both editions, there are times when, like, it's going to look more pleasing to the eye if, like, the participant shifts their body in this way, or if they, like, push out their neck in this way. And the photographers always ask, is it okay if I just show you real quick by turning you or whatnot? And literally just asking for that consent in terms of, like, if there's any physical touching.
That's great. And it's super, super basic when you boil it down like that. Okay. Will you tell our listeners about where they can find you and Survivors and the art that you've been sharing with us?
So our Instagram is instagram.com/survivorsnyc, as well as our Facebook, facebook.com/survivorsnyc. We'll put everything on there, and also if you're looking for a place to buy the latest edition of the magazine and support these projects, which all the money is recycled back into these programs, please click the link in our bio. It's being sold through blurb.com.
Thanks, Maria, for spending a morning with me and telling us about your project. I can personally attest to just how beautiful the magazines are. I just ordered my copy, and there's an option to buy a digital copy too if that's something you'd prefer. I highly recommend it. It's really stunning and really high quality. Check out the program description of this episode to find their social media handles, and remember, the link to buy your copy of Survivors Magazine Volume 2 is in their Instagram bio. Again, super highly recommended. Okay. For the third and final act of our show today, we're moving over to the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, where I chat with two professors and their students about a program they cultivated and created. A real quick note, because both of these professors have so much going on, and I was interviewing them during an incredibly busy time, I did have to hold separate interviews, so we hope that you'll forgive the differences in sound quality.
Hi, I'm Barbara Cassidy. I'm a playwright and director. I'm an adjunct faculty at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And I go by she, her.
Hi, my name is Shauna Trench. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. I'm a professor at John Jay College. I'm in the Department of Anthropology. I'm a linguist, and I am the co-founder of Seeing Rape.
Great, thank you so much. Okay, so what is Seeing Rape?
Sure, so Seeing Rape is first a course that I teach with Shauna Trench, who's an anthropologist and linguist at John Jay. We teach a course over the fall in which we study rape from many different angles and through many different disciplines, focusing a lot, though, on theater and film. The students' final projects are plays that they write. They write original plays about rape. And then we pick plays that we want to put up with professional actors, and we do that in the spring.
And why did you start this program?
Well, Barbara and I both have been working with rape and trying to work with representations of rape on lots of different levels. She is a playwright. Like, how do you represent rape on the stage? What does rape do for you on the stage? Why do plays have rape or don't have rape? But I have been interested in representations of rape, mostly in the legal system, and then how people themselves who have been victimized by sexual violence, how they represent rape and sexual violence linguistically. As a linguist, I'm really interested in narrative and how people's stories change and morph depending on who they tell them to and how they tell them and when people can tell the same story, and it can change dramatically according to context. So since our adversarial system is so into thinking that that's a bald-faced lie, I wanted to show that there are reasons why, social and linguistic reasons why people's stories would change. So then we just started talking, and we thought, wow, we should do a class where we really worked on this idea of representation. You know, we're academics. This is a college. And so we really wanted to do kind of like a hardcore academic study of rape. the whole semester. And we thought that since we are a school of criminal justice, we should have a class that had rape in the title so that students could self-select. They wouldn't be surprised when they came and saw that this would be a semester-long study, so we called it Seeing Rape. And we really liked that idea because it really gets at this notion of representation. How do we represent rape, and how can we maybe represent rape better for people who have been victimized and for those of us who are going to work with people who have been victimized?
Why did you go with performing arts? Why was this the medium that you two picked?
Theater is something that can allow someone to empathize, to kind of take on the role of somebody else. And that, I think, is important for understanding, you know, anything, basically. But in this case, rape, I feel like it gives us a lot of perspective. And, yeah, and I think it's a great medium for students to work in, and really anybody to work in. You know, I think that writing a play, it can be overwhelming maybe sometimes for somebody that hasn't written a play before, but I do think that our students are really particularly gifted in writing plays. They have fabulous dialogue. They don't really think of themselves as playwrights or artists, and then you see that they are, that everybody has it in them to do this, and they have wonderful stories to tell and great voices and very authentic voices. So it's really a pleasure to work with their material.
Great, thank you. So I know you've taught and worked with many students over the past few years, but do any particular students stick out to you? Maybe it was their short play or a transformation you witnessed in them throughout the semester. Does anyone really stick out for you?
It's such a hard question, you know, because for me, it's never just one student, right? Like, the thing that I love about being a professor is the classroom and being in the classroom and seeing that dynamic come together where different people's strengths, you know, build towards a crescendo, maybe in every class. I mean, that's one of the things that, like, I just love about what I'm able to do. And of course, there are always a couple of standout students, right, who help usher that along because they're so fantastic. But I would have to say, like, in every class, it's the class dynamic itself that stands out to me, and especially with something like this, like rape, like there's a closeness that we develop, an intimacy, and one of our students, Morel Ellis, and you know, she's a standout. She talks about how Barbara and I try to create an atmosphere where the students are comfortable with being uncomfortable, and I always love that she says it like that because it's not a comfortable topic. It should never be. But we should figure out ways that we can talk about it, we can learn about it, and, you know, we can create a world without it. And then, you know, the writing can be so brilliant. And that's the thing, too. Like, when you get to the end, you're just like, wow, they've really learned a lot. And they have a lot to teach us. I think that's the thing that is always so brilliant for me, that, like, we can facilitate an atmosphere where everyone can learn and the roles can reverse and we can learn from them. And I was just reading over the plays for this year and I couldn't even believe how amazing they are and how much I'm learning from the plays and from our students' representations.
Sure. How often do you see a degree of self-reflection, either in the students that you teach or the students who come to see the show?
More often than you would think. It's hard to quantify that, but I would say that I had a conversation today with a student in class that, you know, where we were kind of unpacking behaviors that we have in life. What are we doing that's adding to this, and what can we do to change it?
That's awesome. Have you noticed any patterns in your students who take the course?
We do. We definitely see all kinds of patterns. I mean, you know, it's difficult. It's not easy to teach a class like this, right? Because students definitely come in with their conventional wisdom, and that should be something that they can pull on. Often, though, with rape, that conventional wisdom is so hurtful and harmful, oftentimes to people in the class, right? People who have been victimized. We don't ask people to disclose, and most of the time people don't. But then in journals, we read that there are people who have been victimized or their family members have been. And it's really necessary for us to protect them. So it's not the kind of class where you can come in and give your opinions, right? And I don't know that we change everybody's minds or that everybody stops believing in rape myths or stops believing that women ask for it or that they could have avoided it or all of these things that they come in with. But I do think that they learn how to talk about it a little bit better. I think that that's really important. I do think that they see the humanity in people who are victimized, whether or not, like I said, they truly believe. I do think that people start gaining an awareness that, like, well, it might not be cool for me to say she wanted it. right, just because she was at a bar, because we have read so broadly that all kinds of different people in all kinds of different situations are raped, and so that probably isn't why rape occurs, right? We get that far in convincing them, I think, but I don't know that there's a huge shifts among some people, but among others, absolutely. I mean, students will tell us that they see the world in a whole different way. They see women in a whole different way. They see LGBTQ people in a whole different way. So there is something about the class that is about kind of humanizing others in the way that people maybe didn't see before. And I think that another thing that we really talk about is the uses of rape in the class. So it's not just about people who are victimized. It's about how rape is used to victimize people. So people of color, for example, I mean, we teach the Central Park Five, and, you know, seeing rape in that instance, right, where five young black men in New York City, I mean, they were boys. They were not men. They were 14 years old. The whole city saw rape where it did not exist, right? And so we can kind of unpack that and talk about the power of this crime that criminalizes people who are not criminals, but and what kind of social function is happening there. I mean, so it's not just about people who are victimized. It's also about the way that the notions and ideas and stereotypes that we have about rape hurt all kinds of people.
It sounds like you're doing a lot of work around just moving the needle forward a little bit through building critical thinking skills and questioning what we've all been taught about rape. So I have to ask, do you have a favorite unit of the semester?
Maybe one of my favorites is when we teach doubt. I love that film so much and the play. And so we actually do have them read the play. We talk about the play, but then we show some scenes from the film. It's a subject that interests me, the idea of doubt.
I can see that being super interesting. Okay, last question. What is the future of seeing rape?
I hope it doesn't have to exist anymore. That would be great. I mean, I would miss it, but there's other things to go on to in the world, and I really, truly hope that we can get to a much better place. That we don't need a course called Seeing Rape.
So, you know, we have some short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. In the short term, I would say, you know, we want to get this project funded, fully funded, so that everybody involved is paid for their labor, the students too, because these rape plays are so powerful for students because they're written by students and they originate in student experiences and student ideas. And they are coming to form, I think, a campus rape prevention program. But that program shouldn't be built on the backs of students who are not compensated. So we would like to compensate the students. Barbara and I would like compensation, and we would like our actors to become, and everybody who's involved. So that's our short-term goal. Our midterm goal is to create a model for other colleges to kind of institute something that is student-centered in terms of campus rape prevention. And our long-term goal is to eradicate rape.
Those sound like some pretty awesome goals to me, so I'm all for that. Also, if you happen to be a listener with tons of money and don't know what to do with it, get in touch with Shauna and Barbara at John Jay. Okay, you just heard two professors talk about their students and the incredible plays that they write, so let's go meet a few of the students real quick. Okay, thank you so much for being here with me today. So, tell me who you are and why you took this course.
Okay, my name is Artan Giretta. I use he, him pronouns, and my major is fraud examination and forensic accounting. I actually took this class because it was recommended by my friend. And one of the reasons she recommended it is because it's a different type of class. It was different than anything I was taking, all accounting classes. And also she talked about how there were plays chosen, so I just found it interesting.
My name is Denise Singh. I'm the one who recommended the play to him. I'm a forensic psych major, but I'm a gender studies minor. I took the class because I previously took classes with Barbara Cassidy before as well, and she made it known to me like how much of a good class it would be for me, and it would help me on the path that I was going career-wise, so I decided to go ahead.
My name's Nicole. I go by she and her. My major is computer science and information security, and I took this class mainly because rape is something that nobody wants to talk about, but it is a very serious thing, and it's something that needs to be talked about, and people should be aware that there are, you know, different kinds and like the complexities behind it other than what we see on TV and in movies.
I just go by Trina. My major is forensic psychology. And I took this class basically because when I first saw the title, I thought it was actually just physically all about rape. The actual rape, not knowing that it was like plays and just talking about rape within other stuff. So I found that very interesting. So that's why I took the class.
Great. Thank you. In this class with Professors Trinch and Cassidy, what is the most meaningful or memorable moment to you, either inside or outside of class?
I think the most memorable was seeing rape more outside of class, because a lot of the times when you think of rape, you know, you think of like rape scenes and like dark alleys and stuff. And throughout the class, every time I would hear a conversation or see thing outside or like overhear somebody talking, I would think, oh, well, I can bring this up in class because this is an interesting topic, or oh, that does sound like rape culture or something. So just applying it outside of class and seeing how big of a world it actually is was interesting to me.
For me, I would say the most memorable or maybe meaningful thing was that we got to keep a journal that we were supposed to be writing in regularly. And that meant a lot to me just because there were times in class or like during a reading where I would read something and like feel kind of like what was going on, and it would make me a little bit uncomfortable. And I liked that I was able to write about it and kind of express that and get that out, rather than, you know, keeping it inside and going to class feeling, you know, uncomfortable or just weird. And also that they gave you the opportunity to step out of class at any time you felt like, you know, there was something that you just couldn't handle.
That is really, really great. Okay, so what is your short play about, and why did you choose this topic?
Our play is called Serena, and it's about this guy and a girl, and it sort of follows their meeting and has a lot of twists and turns, but it deals with rape, it deals with rape culture, and it also deals with the fact of how people look at different genders when it comes to rape.
I didn't want it to be like, oh, a girl goes to a bar, gets drugged. I wanted it to be as unique as possible, where people are questioning, was it rape, was it not rape? And there's things left out, things for the audience to question.
We're basically trying to make sure people understand that, you know, rape isn't just somebody gets attacked. It's like different things that can happen in everyday life, and we do see it a lot on campus, we just don't realize it.
My short play is called No Means Whatever I Say. It basically takes place in an all-women's penitentiary. A female is being raped by another female CO. And also, the investigator, he doesn't really pay them any mind because that they're black. So it also has a color content towards it as well. So we want to pay attention to that. And also that she's a female, she's being raped by another female CO, and nobody really cares, and all the inmates come in and try to help out. I wanted to talk about two females because you never hear the same-sex rape at all. To me, I never hear the same-sex at all. So I found it very interesting to talk about the same sex.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the LGBTQ community gets left out of these narratives all the time, so I'm really glad that you're actively including that narrative. Okay, so last question. What is your hope for anyone who sees the show this year? What do you want people to walk away with?
I want them to be more aware about rape. You know, we're like in the Harvey Weinstein era sort of thing, so it's important for people to see like, oh yeah, there are women coming out, there are men coming out, but that's not everyone. There are people whose cases are still being dealt with, or people who don't want to talk about it because they don't see it as the typical, you know, oh, this is what rape is. So I feel like I want people to walk away and look at things differently and see, oh, well, maybe I should intervene here, or oh, maybe this person's uncomfortable, let me step back for a second. So just something that they can take with them throughout life, basically.
I guess to just get a different perspective on things. The plays are interesting, so just getting the entertainment out of that and seeing the stories people came up with and just having an open mind, I guess. Just enjoying the plays, learning from them as much as you can.
Well, I hope that anyone that comes to see the play loves the plays, for one. And, you know, would like to take part in it because it's a wonderful experience. You get to learn about these things, and some of these things or topics is very hidden under and you don't know what's going on. So it's just open up your mind. So I hope that anybody that comes and see it likes it and wants to be part.
Yeah, I definitely feel the same. I hope people enjoy what they see. And I also really hope that people take away what I took away, is that there are so many different aspects to rape. Like, rape is one word, but there are so many other umbrellas that people just don't know about that also need to be explored.
It sounds like Professors Trinch and Cassidy have done an incredible job with teaching this class, and listen, the short plays that these students have written are just phenomenal. I can personally vouch for the incredible quality of the show. Our agency has been really blessed to be asked to be part of the programming around Seeing Rape, and we strongly recommend making it a priority to attend next year. It usually goes up around early May. The thing that strikes me most about Seeing Rape is the sheer diversity of the plays and monologues. We get to see stories that involve people who are incarcerated, people who belong to the LGBTQ community, people with multiple traumas, people of color. They even had a show last year where half the dialogue was in Spanish, which I thought was awesome. It is truly incredible, and more than once have I heard students talking afterward about how surprised they were at how good and engaging the shows were. The show definitely starts conversations, and I think that's why it has such great potential to be a permanent form of prevention programming. We hope you enjoyed our show today about campus artivism, and we really hope that you will consider supporting all of these incredible artists. Whether it's buying the latest volume of Survivors Magazine, going to Emma's next show, or going to see Seeing Rape next year, we know you won't regret it. We want the whole world to know about the work that they're doing and the beauty that they're putting out into the world. Make sure you check out the episode description to find all of the social media handles for those who have them. Thank you to the Alliance staff and specifically my supervisors for giving me the green light and supporting me on this project and this episode. To Nikki Cruz, our social media guru, you make my life so easy. And of course, to all of our artists that were featured today, Emma, Maria and her team, Shauna, Barbara, Artan, Denise, Nicole, Trina, and all of the other Seeing Rape playwrights. Also, an extra special shout out to all the graduating students out there. Congratulations, you did it. You can finally sleep in. Remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Google Play, and tell your friends to do the same. We hope to bring you more conversations, and of course, we always want to hear from you. If you want to get in touch with us, if you have feedback or thoughts on this episode, or you have a topic that you'd like for us to talk about, you can tweet at us at NYCAASA or message us on Instagram at NYCAlliance, and make sure you use our hashtag #SexTalkHappyHour, all one word. Thanks so much for listening in today. Ciao for now. We'll see you next time.